This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In 1959, 17-year-old Gary Presley was standing in line, wearing his favorite cowboy boots and waiting for his final inoculation, a booster shot against polio. 7 days later, a bad headache caused him to skip basketball practice. By the next day, burning with the fever of polio, he was fastened into the claustrophobic cocoon of an iron lung. That would be his home for the next 3 months. He never walked again. Gary Presley has written a memoir of his experience and the nearly 50 years since he took his last step. It's titled Seven Wheelchairs, A Life Beyond Polio, published by the University of Iowa Press. And Gary Presley joins us for the hour. This is a tremendous work of writing. I love to be involved in talking to authors of these types of memoirs, painful, powerful, also joyful here, in following you in this book through your life's journey. Let's start off, Gary, if we could, with the day in Missouri when you got that booster shot and what followed.
I remember the shot because I remember the person I was with. He was my best friend, and we were laughing and joking. I don't remember that I was ever afraid of the shots because I'd grown up in a military family, and we'd had to take a number of inoculations every time we traveled. But the shot was a shot. It was the last in the series. My mother was tremendously afraid of polio because she'd grown up in the during the big epidemics in California during the Depression and shortly thereafter. So she had us down, my brother and I, to the clinics immediately when they were available. I took the first one in Spokane, Washington, and the second one in El Paso, Texas. That's the way of the military. And my father had retired, and I took the next one at the little town of Hurley, Missouri.
Now, it was 7 days later that you were at basketball practice. You asked to be excused. You wanted to just get a ride home. You had a headache at beginning, and then you went home. You were helping your father out in the barn to milk cows, and then you found you couldn't do that and had to go in. The next morning, you awoke and literally fell out of bed.
Right. I didn't feel ill. I swung, my brother and I slept in bunk beds, and I swung out of bed and fell on the floor. And actually, most of the pain had left by then. It had begun with a headache and a weakness. And a neighbor helped my father load me in a car, and we took off for Springfield and ended up at a place called Baptist Hospital.
You remarked in the book how you were looking down at your body. It was not moving. It appeared, you said you were not in at really any pain at this point. Your body just was not working. Tell us now what, we're not in the era, thank God, of a lot of people having polio. What is polio? What was polio doing to your body at that moment?
Oddly, it was if there were still sensations, but there was no ability to move. It felt like a disconnect between reality and intention. So it there was no pain. I just simply couldn't lift my legs. It was, and I assumed there was still fever, so I was no doubt confused. And a 17-year-old boy is not the most sophisticated organism on earth. So I probably just didn't know what was going on.
Do you know why you got polio when how many others that went through this series of shots and nothing happened?
Some research that I've done indicates that there were some bad batches of vaccine early on, 1955 or 56. But I've never really known. Physicians have argued with me, but I don't think it's coincidental that I came down with polio 7 days after taking the final in the series of inoculations. But it may just be the genetic luck of the draw.
And there was a period when you concentrated on blaming, finding blame here, and you write in the book about how this was not a good approach for you to continue your life, to blame and kind of crippling yourself mentally.
Right. I do think that people need to deal with the reality of what is. I once read Viktor Frankl, who said that the last freedom is your attitude, that cannot be taken away from you. And in a great measure, as an immature individual, as all 17-year-olds are, you concentrate on self, and so you are most likely to look at what's wrong rather than what's right. So it takes a long time, if you're a normal human being, to get over what's wrong and concentrate on what's right.
Did the writings of Viktor Frankl, a concentration camp survivor, did you turn to those at any point to help you?
Later on,
not initially.
Not initially. Mostly I read Hemingway and Faulkner early on.
How did they help you?
Not much. Not much.
Hemingway, a very active man, and you couldn't be that man anymore.
Right.
Talk about the time that you spent 3 months living in an iron lung. Not an image of our era, again, an image from a half century ago, a large tube that a person is placed in to aid breathing when normal muscle control has been lost or partially lost, a type of medical ventilator, I believe.
Right.
You were put in this for 3 months. Tell us about some of the things you remember from those 3 months.
Early on, confusion, massive confusion because of the very high fevers. And then because I didn't allow the nurses and the attendants to move me, I developed pneumonia. And pneumonia added to the fevers. That added to the confusion. Now I have the scars to prove that I didn't allow them to move me because I stayed in one place so long that I developed serious pressure sores, which made things worse. In some way, I think they failed me as much as I failed myself. That's not to excuse me, but it shows the difference in attitude toward medical treatment now. I wouldn't be allowed now to resist the proper treatment, which was movement. They would take you out and move you around in order to relieve pressure.
There were a lot of things that were not explained to you in this era of medical care, and your writing really brings it home. For instance, you talked about having pneumonia. The day the doctors arrived to drain your lungs because you were suffering from pneumonia is a horrifying account, and I wonder if you can share some of that with us.
I think I used in the book, I used the phrase, "I am doctor, you are disease."
Yes.
And I do think that was the attitude, a paternalistic attitude toward people. Rather than explain what they were going to do, they just did what they wanted to do. Part of that, I couldn't have resisted them either, anyway. I wasn't of majority age, so my parents could have forced me to take the treatment.
But to get a picture of this, you were put down, your head was bent back,
right,
and there were some rigid tubes
they
put down into your lungs.
Right. They call it a rigid bronchoscopy, I think, or something like that. I've never looked up the term. But it's a pipe. They bend your head back, and you do the sword swallowing technique. It's the same thing that a sword swallower does. And then they drain the infection from your lungs with that.
Mm-hmm. spitting became a form of protest, you write in the book.
It's an ugly chapter, don't you think?
Yeah, it is.
It's really an ugly chapter, but it's the truth. It's a truth. When they broke the pneumonia, no one would come and help me clean my mouth. And the nurse would say, swallow it. It's just infection. But in some way, I guess subconsciously, it represented all that I hated about where I was. So I laid in the iron lung and spit on the floor. And no one could stop me. So in some way, that was a small measure of victory.
Some sense of control when you were helpless otherwise.
Right.
And what's surprising here, too, is that you make observations of the book that some people treated you as a human. Some were completely detached. Some were embarrassed when they would walk by in the hallway
right.
and see you and scurry on by.
Right. Everything in the iron lung is seen through a mirror unless somebody puts their face over you.
There's an actual mirror above the faceplate.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, you're in the tube with your head stuck out through a rubber gasket assembly, and there's a mirror, which could be substituted for a book rack if necessary.
Today on The Exchange, talking with Gary Presley, Seven Wheelchairs, the title of his memoir published by University of Iowa Press, A Life Beyond Polio. Let's talk about the challenge of dependency, Gary. You went from being a strong, healthy young man and an army brat turned farm kid in Missouri to being completely dependent almost overnight. What are some of the hardest things about that?
Initially, it's the idea that, especially if you're quadriplegic, it's the idea that you need help with the most basis of functions. I had to use a bedpan in the iron lung. I couldn't go to the bathroom or urinate unless I had someone help me. There's a very significant detachment between who you are and your physical self. And it's a confusing thing. Perhaps now, if it happened now, I might be able to rationalize it. Mm. But even now, even after 50 years, there are elements where I hate the fact that I'm dependent for assistance, and I carry a buried anger, mm-hmm. I think, with it.
Does it ever come out in dreams that you imagine yourself running?
Mostly I dream about being partially paralyzed, which is very odd to me. I will dream that I still use a wheelchair, but that I can drive, or that I still use a wheelchair, but I can stand up. It's never. My dreams are never about reality. There's a lot of dreams of the past, and I've tried to write about that. I've tried an essay about that, but I've never been able to fully understand the nature of my dreams.
You're now sitting in front of me in your seventh wheelchair. You call it Little Red. Listeners might have noticed here when in talking to you that there's a sound in the background. That's a portable respirator that you use on occasion. Explain what that respirator is doing.
The respirator, over a period of years, I did completely without a respirator. I was able to wean myself from first the iron lung, and then a pneumatic belt, and then a rocking bed, which was a very comforting thing. And I went without respiratory assistance until 1987, when I collapsed from post-polio syndrome. And since then, I've used a respirator at night and sometimes during the day, and as I've aged more often, it's another tool. I'm happy being alive. I'm curious about what the next day is going to bring, and so I don't resent the respirator, but it keeps me from being fatigued, and so I'm willing to use it.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break and come back with more from Gary Presley, the author of the new book, Seven Wheelchairs, A Life Beyond Polio, published by the University of Iowa Press. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with The Exchange here on Iowa Public Radio. My guest today, Gary Presley. Seven Wheelchairs, the title of his new book, just published by the University of Iowa Press, A Life Beyond Polio. In 1959, when he was just 17, Gary received a booster shot against polio, and instead of enhancing his immunity, it produced a major paralysis. He has been in a wheelchair for nearly 50 years, and when we had the break here, Gary, you mentioned today's date and what we think is an eerie coincidence here.
Yes. I'd been thinking about this over a period of weeks ever since the press invited me to Iowa City. And as I recall, and I have no medical records or any way to prove it exactly, but I think this is the last day that I walked. I think that it was October 3rd that
1959,
which is a strange thing to think about, if someone had told me that day that I was walking toward Iowa City 49 years later, I wouldn't have believed them.
You couldn't have imagined yourself in this position at this time. You write dark moments. I want to talk about the joyful moments, too, in a moment. But one of the other dark moments you write about in here, if I can quote from the book, you write, "Even as I grew in strength and began to seize upon those pleasures becoming available as I rolled along about the world, I still carried the suicide demon along for the ride." How close did you come to attempting suicide?
Not very. I always think of suicide as a door. It's always available to anyone, although it's not a rational choice. But I never slit my wrist or overdosed on pills. I thought of it more as a as something as a reflection, a manifestation of anger. And as we were talking earlier about anger being a form of self-pity, so suicide was just another the thoughts of suicide or was just another way of dramatizing my self-pity.
So if you have someone who's been newly disabled in front of you and as you did, suffering major depression, wondering, what is this life for now? What could I possibly have in this life? What props you up?
What props you up? You'll find it. It has to be something from within yourself. But I do think in our current society, there's a lot more resources available. No one ever dealt with me about attitude, about psychological health, about emotional support. Even in the rehabilitation center, there was never any psychological support, never any, "This is who you are. This is who you will be. This is who you can be. And here's how you're going to deal with it." Or here's tools to deal with it. No one ever said anything other than you need to use a cushion or practical things to deal with in using a wheelchair. Nobody
paid attention to your mind.
No. And that I think now to use the popular term, is most people that are severely injured and become paraplegic or quadriplegic, or have an illness that leaves them in a quadriplegic or paraplegic state, go through post-traumatic stress, and they develop the same psychological conditions.
You had to navigate in a wheelchair since 1959, the early 60s, before the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, which was a wide-ranging civil rights law that prohibits, under certain circumstances, discrimination based on disability. You are a perfect subject to ask how that has improved life for people with physical disabilities.
In a practical sense, it's meant accessible buildings, accessible restrooms, parking spaces. But in a basic sense that makes things better for people with disabilities, it is most manifested in education and employment opportunities. The first time I ever applied for a job that I really wanted, I got the job because a man liked the way I approached the duties. But his manager, the owner of the business, told him that he shouldn't have hired me because I used a wheelchair, and people in wheelchairs are always ill. And that wasn't the attitude 35 years ago. Disability was illness. But it isn't, and the law now, the Americans with Disabilities Act especially, makes that clear.
Despite the advances that have been made, and you just pointed out several of those, what would you like to see still happen pertaining to people with disabilities in our society?
Better access to health care, remedial equipment, and the practical things that allow people with disability to move in society without hindrance. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to see that happen without another layer of bureaucracy.
Hmm. Before we go to calls, I want to have you talk a little bit about Belinda. You've mentioned her a couple times this time. You were married, your wife, and you were married in, I believe, 1992, if I'm recalling that correctly. This book has a love story at the ending of it. At the end, you write about meeting and marrying Belinda. How did meeting Belinda change your life?
I know Belinda is the first person that ever saw the internal Gary rather than the external Gary.
In fact, she said early on, she didn't, you don't see this wheelchair? She said, I don't see that wheelchair.
No, she saw, as I see in her, the elemental friendship, the elemental connection between two people that are necessary, that's necessary in order to have a marriage or a friendship.
Very good. Let's go to Karna in Storm Lake.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Karna. How are you?
I'm good. Is the sun shining in Iowa City?
Yes, it is, but
good.
It's chilly.
Good. Well, you sound great on the radio.
Thank you.
Hey, Gary, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the writing process, and specifically sharing your personal stories, writing memoir that definitely has a meaning for family and friends. But when it's read by the wide public, who really do you hope reads this book, and what kinds of conversations do you hope it generates?
I think it was very difficult for me to understand that my family was going to read this, but I thought the story was more important than any hurt feelings that might be generated. I think I want people to understand that internally, everyone is the same. We are all human beings with fragile portions and strong portions, and that disability, or at least a perceivable disability, something that's seen on the surface, maybe irrelevant to personhood. Mm-hmm. As far as the writing process, I tried to write so as not to hurt other people. I changed the names of people within the book that I may have spoken, who may not have wanted to be portrayed the way I portrayed them. But there's an element in me that has grown open enough to understand that I need to reveal my weaknesses in order to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. And so to answer Karna's question, the takeaway for readers, you hope, here is?
The fact that we're all in the same boat, mm-hmm. that because I use a wheelchair doesn't make me any better, any worse than anyone else.
What were those? You mentioned the difficult parts to family, family members, close friends. What are the most difficult? Were the most difficult things to have published?
I think from some of the reviews I've read and some of the comments I've heard, that people are taking away images of my father that aren't exactly what I would want people to believe about him. Mm-hmm. He was a good man, but he comes across as stoic and unfeeling. But at least some people have said that. But I don't think he was unfeeling. I just don't think I understood him correctly.
And your mother and your father were very much in contrast in the way when you went to Omaha for rehabilitation, your mother was there quite often. Your father was back on the farm most of the time.
Because he was very self-reliant. And so he wouldn't turn his responsibilities. We had a dairy then. And so he wouldn't ask a neighbor to come in and take care of his cattle so that he could go to Omaha, and we didn't have the money to pay someone to do it.
Looking back, how do you see your mother dealing with her boy, her firstborn?
I was the only child for almost 9 years, and my father was absent for a good portion of those early years, and I was raised primarily by my mother and my grandmother during World War II and immediately afterwards. And my mother treasured me, I think. And I think it literally broke her heart that I came down with polio. She must have felt maybe I'm projecting on her, but she must have felt a tremendous guilt.
Did you ever talk to her about
that? I tried to, mostly in reassurance, because I wanted the shot.
What did you want to reassure her about?
That I wanted the shot. That if the shot was there, I would have taken them. I knew what polio was. I understood what it was meant to prevent. I don't resent taking the shot. Think of all the good that the vaccines have done. It's irrelevant that I spent 49 years in a wheelchair. It's irrelevant.
Irrelevant.
It is. It's irrelevant. It's my life, and God gave it to me. And if I'm a believer, I've had a good life. I try to release a little bit of good karma in the world every day. So at this point in my life, yes, the wheelchair is irrelevant.
Where do you find your greatest joys these days?
My marriage, my writing, and my dogs.
Your dogs. How many dogs do you have?
We have two.
Uh-huh.
I think dogs are what is it that they say? It's no accident that dog is God spelled backwards.
I had never heard that.
But I do take, Belinda says it's lucky that we live in a condominium instead of a house with a large acreage, or I'd have 100 dogs. I absolutely love dogs.
What type of dogs do you have?
We have Boston Bulldogs, and that's a deliberate choice. When I was born, or when I was, when my mother and father were married early on, it was right at the beginning of World War II, and my father was first sergeant of an anti-aircraft company, and the company dog was a Boston Bulldog.
Tell me, let's go back to the question further on with the question from Karna in
Storm Lake.
Storm Lake.
She's
right.
A member of my riding group.
I was thinking of Northwest Iowa, and I couldn't come up with Storm Lake right away. Thank you. When you were talking about string theory in your first essay that won you that competition, and then you started to write for the first time about your disability, about your personal life, to people who are writers listening to this program, to those who aspire to write a memoir, what advice can you give in terms of what, how to relay those feelings, what to write, what not to write?
I believe essentially that there is truth and then there are truths. And if my brother had written this book, or if Belinda had written this book, or if my father had written this book, it would be a different book entirely. And so you have to be willing to tell your own truth, which may not be another person's truth. The second thing is you have to be willing to be seen as fragile and vulnerable and as sometimes less than you would want to be seen.
In order to be genuine.
Yes. Yes, I really think that people are too concerned about the facade that they show the world. And so the one thing that this book has taught me, I used to read a lot of black humor, and Peter DeVries was a favorite author of black humor, and he has one of his characters say in his novel, a novel, I can't remember which one, human nature is pretty shabby stuff, as you may know from introspection. And I've always treasured that saying because it's given me permission to be who I am.
When you write memoir, these personal things, how much weight do you have to give, consideration do you have to give to family members who appear in this? Do they get to vet a copy or raise objections?
Belinda doesn't think it shows my real personality.
This book. Why not?
She thinks I'm much happier than the book seems to illustrate. Although I can't say that really. I don't know. I don't really know who I am. This book is part of who I am, but another part of who I am, I may not even know. We had a discussion among a group of friends that are writers about writing about family members, perhaps children. I don't think I could have written this book if my parents were still alive. I really don't. I think
it would have been too painful for them.
Right. And I'm a religious person. I'm a spiritual person. I believe they understand why I wrote it now. If their spirits know what happens on earth, they understand why I wrote it, and they forgive me if it's necessary that I have forgiveness.
We have to go right now. Gary Presley, I want to thank you very much. It's been a delightful hour to have you sharing your thoughts.
I appreciate being here.
And your new book, Seven Wheelchairs, the title of Gary Presley's memoir, A Life Beyond Polio.